about her book, Dragnet Nation, A Quest for Privacy, Security, and Freedom in a World of Relentless Surveillance. Julia, welcome back to Democracy Now! It's great to have you with us. I mean, it was amazing to see this absolute bipartisan, almost consensus in the particular hearing that the CEO of TikTok was being questioned at, being grilled and demanding that TikTok be sold to a U.S. company in order for it to be saved. Talk about what Bowman said, what AOC has said, and what you think are the major concerns here.
Thank you so much for having me on. It's great to be here. And I have to say, it was amazing to watch Congress finally taking privacy seriously, but only for one app, right? So I have been writing about privacy issues. I published my book almost a decade ago, and people have been trying to get Congress to pass a federal privacy law that would protect our data on all of our apps and all of the different ways that we are mediated by technology. And we're one of the only Western nations that has not passed such a bill. And so now we have, of course, this frenzy around TikTok and this idea that they're the ones who we really need to be protected against. And the reality is there's really nothing that TikTok is accused of that the other social media platforms haven't done as well.
And isn't there also the issue of the question of governments being able to use these apps for their own ends? I would assume that anything that China can do, the Chinese government can do with TikTok, the U.S. government can do with the American social media apps that are spread around the world.
I mean, it's a really good point that all of these social media platforms can and have been manipulated and censored by governments, right? And so most recently, the most recent example we've seen of this actually was that there's a Twitter employee who recently was just convicted of spying on Saudi dissidents on behalf of the Saudi government. And so he uses access as an employee in order to spy on government, on Twitter users. And, you know, Google over the years has said that they have dismissed more than a dozen employees for misusing data about Google users. And so we've seen that this kind of thing can happen at all of the platforms. It's also true that you don't have to own a platform in order to misuse it, right? So in the 2016 election, we know that Facebook was basically used by Russian propagandists to spread misinformation. We know that Facebook's platform was used by the Myanmar government to spread lies and hate against the Rohingyas, which then led to a genocide. We know that Facebook's platform was used by people organizing the Capitol insurrection on January 6th, and that Facebook didn't stop that. And so we know these platforms can be misused. And there's no question that China could also, of course, try to misuse the TikTok platform. But what's interesting is that TikTok has proposed a plan that would wall off U.S. data from China's access. It basically has said to the government, we would store all of our data about U.S. users at Oracle, a U.S. company, and we would actually submit to oversight by the Treasury-led Committee on Foreign Investment in the U.S. So essentially that committee would be able to inspect their algorithm to see if they're promoting disinformation from China or any other state, and also would be able to inspect to make sure that the data about U.S. people is not being transmitted back to China. That's a level of control and state control over an app that we haven't seen before, and also is way more oversight than any of the other social media platforms have been exposed to.
And I'm wondering the broader implications of Congress trying to ban TikTok, especially in view of the fact that the United States for the last 40, 50 years has been the main proponent of globalization, of breaking down barriers between countries and letting companies extend their reach and their trade I'm wondering, for instance, the similar battle that happened over Huawei and 5G and the spread of 5G around the world, with the United States, instead of welcoming greater intercourse between countries, was actually seeking to shut down the ability of a Chinese company to market a 5G technology around the world. What's this going to do to the potential for individual countries now to begin to close their borders to trade and commerce in the digital age?
I mean, this is a really good point, right? So if we put the proposals on the table are, A, to put TikTok under state control, to ban it, or to force a sale. All three of those things are things that I think the U.S. government would really be mad about if some other country tried to do to one of our companies, right? Right now, already, if you think about the social media platforms and how they behave around the world, although we often like to be mad at them for various reasons, and we have lots of reasons to be mad often, the reality is that they're being asked in most countries to act as government censors, right? So like in India, there have been huge pressure on the tech platforms to do censorship on behalf of the government. And some of that censorship, the companies have argued, is illegal, right? And so they are actually out there fighting for their users to have free expression. And that's true in a lot of countries. These companies actually spend a lot of time fighting with the governments to try to make sure their platforms can be a place where everyone has a voice. And so for the U.S. to suddenly say, okay, we want to support freedom of expression around the world, right? We do that not only through our private companies, but through our foreign diplomacy and our USAID, et cetera. We now actually don't want it at home, right? We're going to actually basically censor TikTok here. It makes it really hard for us to justify supporting freedom of expression around the world.
So let me ask you about other parts of the RESTRICT Act, which is co-sponsored. I mean, all of this is bipartisan in a time when the Congress couldn't be more partisan. But I'm going after China on this. You've got Senator Thune and you've got Senator Warner and, of course, others that are co-sponsoring. So we know that they want TikTok to be sold to a U.S. company. But can you talk about other aspects of RESTRICT Act? Is it true you could face $1 million fine if you access TikTok? And also, what does this say about restricting VPNs? And explain what they are.
So the RESTRICT Act is basically this bipartisan bill that has come about because the White House apparently believes that they don't actually have the legal authority to ban TikTok. So they were floating this ban and then realized that they needed the legal authority. So this bill, as far as I understand it, is actually meant to give them that legal authority that they don't feel like they have right now. And so it empowers the Commerce Department to do some evaluations of different apps and to see what their risks are and then to take different measures to counteract them, including a ban. And so I think that the fact that it's bipartisan supported is a sign of how united Congress is right now. I mean, I've never seen the Dems and Republicans on the same side so aggressively as on this particular issue. And it really is interesting because they're not united on privacy as a larger issue, right? Like, the privacy bills have not moved, but this issue, which is more, I think, a China issue than a privacy issue, right? The reality is the reason they're united is because everyone sees political capital in uniting to fight against the China threat, right? Now, you asked me about VPNs. VPNs are virtual private networks. So basically, it's something you would put on your phone in order to route around your internet provider. It's often used in places like China where the government is censoring internet traffic, and it's a way to try to circumvent that censorship. And so it's interesting that you would think of restricting that when, in fact, that's something we tend to export to other nations in order to promote freedom of expression.
And could you talk a little about the difference in approach to dealing with social media and technology by the European Union versus what the kinds of legislation that Congress is considering?
Yeah, I mean, that's such a great question. The EU has been just years and years ahead of the United States in terms of taking the threats from these platforms seriously and addressing them thoughtfully. So, for instance, they passed a comprehensive privacy law back in 2018 that has laid out, you know, basic standards for how data should be treated, what kind of rights users have over their data. And then this year, actually, new laws are coming into place to regulate the algorithms. So it's the first time that algorithms are going to be regulated. These social media companies that are above a certain size will have to report to the EU on the—they have to measure the risks that their algorithms are creating to things like teen mental health, the risks to democracy. These are really big and important questions that the companies have to answer. Then they have to show how they're going to mitigate those risks. And that is something that is really creative way to try to approach this issue without censorship. So the idea is the EU is not saying, like, we've decided that this is a bad thing for democracy. They're saying you need to measure that risk. It's on you to show how you're promoting democracy and how you're not allowing for authoritarianism. And so I think it's an interesting experiment, and the U.S. hasn't done any of that, right? Like, we are nowhere near regulating algorithms. We haven't set a basic privacy law. And, you know, the templates are out there. I will say this, though. California has passed a really strong privacy law that basically emulates the EU law. And so in California, there is actually a strong privacy law that goes into effect this year. And so we are finally catching up on the California level. But, of course, Congress has been threatening to preempt that law with something weaker. So we may not actually get to keep that.
We only have about 30 seconds, Julia, but especially for young people. It is critical, especially for young people on mental health issues, the increase in suicide. What exactly can be done, and as with other issues that you're raising, can the companies really regulate themselves?
Right. I don't think the companies can regulate themselves. We've had decades of them pretending to regulate themselves, and I think we have pretty clear evidence that that's not working. So I do think we need to collectively as a society determine what our important goals are and force them to do it. And I think teen mental health is one where, A, there's not enough research on exactly what is causing the teen mental health problems and how much social media plays in. And two, we haven't put any laws in place to sort of enforce the companies to take that issue seriously.
Julia Angwin, investigative journalist, will link to your new article, How to Fix the TikTok Problem, author of Dragnet Nation, A Quest for Privacy, Security, and Freedom in a World of Relentless Surveillance. Coming up, bootstrapped, liberating ourselves from the American dream. Stay with us.
There's only one song worth singing. They may try and sell you.
Music by Cass Elliot, very popular on TikTok. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. We end today's show with journalist Alyssa Cord, executive director of the Economic Hardship Reporting Project, where she worked closely for years with the late Barbara Ehrenreich. Her new book is called Bootstrapped, Liberating Ourselves from the American Dream. In it, she critically examines the American narrative of self-reliance that emphasizes success as a result of individual hard work. The myth shapes our policies as portrayed in popular culture, including the Horatio Alger stories, Ayn Rand's books, Atlas Shrugged and The Fountainhead, and television shows like in the Reagan-era series Little House on the Prairie, about a family's life on the American frontier. For Little House on the Prairie. And Alyssa Cord, welcome back to Democracy Now! You write in your preface to Bootstrapped, quote, "I receive messages from strangers about how the poor are responsible for their own poverty on a routine basis. Those who are economically on the edge, they write, just need to pull themselves up by their bootstraps." Can you lay out what this means as the granddaughter of a couple who owned a shoe store in the Bronx? Why you think a bootstrap is key to understanding the false narrative that is developed in this country?
Yeah, so what I see, I run this organization that Barbara Ehrenreich and I created, Economic Hardship Reporting Project, and we got these letters and comments that would be sort of blaming our writers for the poverty they experienced and the difficulties they experienced. And I wanted to get the bottom of it. What was this about? And the more I looked into it, it seemed like it was just this story of shame and blame that has followed people who struggle in this country since the 19th century. And I really see it in the early writings of people like Horatio Alger, etc.
About Horatio Alger in particular, you really go into him in the book.
Yes. I mean, Horatio Alger wrote over 100 novels, and they were all these stories of these young men. They have names like Tony the Tramp or Ragged Dick, and they were very young, I mean, teenagers. And when you look at the stories, though, supposedly the Horatio Alger story is about luck and pluck, about a young man through hard work making it in America, coming from nothing. In truth, he always meets an older gentleman who is rich, who saves him, basically, and makes him into a success story. Horatio Alger himself committed pedophilic acts, had been a minister, had been chased out of the church in Massachusetts. And I think we need to look at these stories, we need to look at the people who created them, to see some of the hypocrisy and also the complexity. You know, these young men were not doing this, the teenagers were not making themselves into success stories from nothing by themselves. They had the help of wealthy elder people. And that's really how things work in this country.
And the title Bootstrapped, it struck me, Alyssa, because Puerto Rico in the 1940s and 1950s adopted an industrial and economic policy called Operation Bootstrap. It was supposedly the island was going to lift itself out of poverty. Of course, the reality was that the method used tax exemptions, federal tax exemptions, local tax exemptions, to lure companies to come to Puerto Rico to set up shop. So it really was not a country lifting itself up. It was using the tax system to benefit corporations that would then help lift the island up. This whole idea of the bootstrap, you talk in your book about how the concept even originally began.
Yeah, so that's a great point, that example from Puerto Rico. I mean, the concept of bootstrapping is an impossibility. You cannot pull your boots on by your bootstraps. You certainly can't pull yourself up by your bootstraps. And it started out, actually, in 1834 as a joke. It was a phrase, an absurdity, that somehow became something to aspire to over the decades that passed. And I think we need to remember it's still an absurdity. Nobody is able to do this alone. You need infrastructure. You need a tax base. You need parents. You need schools. And this is the message that I'm hoping we'll get through from this book. And it's also a message that has to do with the pandemic. It's things we learned during the pandemic about relying on each other and surviving with the help of others.
I'd like to ask you also about something that is bandied about a lot these days in Congress and in terms of dealing with financial problems of the country, the word entitlements for use for referring to Social Security, for example. Could you talk about that?
Yeah, I mean, I think even the word entitlement, and part of what I'm doing in this book is looking at the language that people use to demonize people who are financially struggling, this kind of idea of the undeserving poor and the opposite, the deserving rich. So, I mean, if we look at what just happened at Silicon Valley Bank and other banks that have just gotten a bailout, they've gotten entitlements on a massive scale, and yet they're not being shamed and blamed for it like people who are kicked off of welfare rolls or have to recertify for SNAP on a constant basis. And I think we need to look at the double standard that we have for people who are at the top of the pyramid economically and those towards the bottom.
So, Alyssa Cord, I want to follow up on that. As the debt is going to be negotiated, the whole debt ceiling and the question really of these programs being put on the table, you go back in time. And I think your story about Ayn Rand, right, who at the Fountainhead, Atlas Shrugged, worshipped by Alan Greenspan and so many others, the story of Ayn Rand herself and what she relied on and how these programs for her were essential at the end of her life.
Yeah, at the end of her life, Ayn Rand, who's this it's great Silicon Valley Bank. It's the perfect segue because, you know, a lot of these technologists worship her. I think some of them have like boats named after the Fountainhead and kind of books that Ayn Rand wrote. But in truth, at the end of her life, she was dependent on Medicare and Social Security. She had had lung cancer, and she used a proxy, like sort of a friend or assistant, to get those services for her. But they were in her name. And this is somebody who said, oh, I'm on my, you know, you have to survive on your own. You know, everybody has to accrue as much power as they possibly can. And that's the only thing that matters. And at the end, like so many of us, she was dependent. She was dependent on her acquaintances, nurses, and ultimately the state. And I think we need to remember that.
You wrote a New York Times piece headlined, Can We Put an End to America's Most Dangerous Myth? And in it, you cite a 2020 Pew study which found that 60% of Republicans say personal choices are one of the main contributors to economic inequality. What do you think accounts for this belief?
Well, I think there's something called loss aversion, where you have people who are sort of in the middle class, let's say. I mean, a lot of the Trump supporters, if we look back at their earnings, they earned like something like an average of $71,000 a year. These were not poor people. But they were afraid of falling down the ladder. And I think that's something that means that they put too much value almost in the power of their own hard work and determination to protect them from falling down the ladder. They sort of use it almost as a kind of magical thinking. And so I think that's reflected in that study.
I think what's so really interesting about your book, Bootstrapped, is the way you look at popular culture, whether we're talking about Ayn Rand, and as you said, like ends up on Social Security and using Medicare and needs that. But we think about her as the person who's completely separate from anything like that, to Little House on the Prairie that shaped so much of the 1980s in popular culture. Talk about the Homestead Act. Talk about what shaped this country, what people relied on, but then what they deny once they rise to the top.
Yeah, so Homestead Act of 1862 is the biggest, to date, land giveaway that this country has ever seen. And anytime you see these stories about pioneers, including Little House on the Prairie, there's a great likelihood that they received a parcel of land from the U.S. government, and that was what led to their farming and their future success, their property holding. Of course, this land was originally, let's just be frank, stolen from indigenous people. Majority of the people who received it were white. Many were men. And that is the story that begins this country as, you know, the West, the settling of the West. And in Little House on the Prairie and this kind of popular culture, we're just seeing the rugged individualism. We're not seeing the social generosity at the root of it. So when I'm trying to myth bust in this book, I keep trying to point out the spaces where people had a hand out and a hand up that they may be denying, because I think that's part of what we need to do. We need to start critiquing the self-made myth in politics, in a contemporary politics, and also historically. And we have to go back in the past to get to the future. So we have to look at things like the Homestead Act, and we have to look at things like the GI Bill that were real acts of social giving that have helped people survive. And we need to use them rhetorically when we're asking for more support for our citizens.
Over the years, Donald Trump has repeatedly portrayed himself as a self-made billionaire whose only head start was a small loan of $1 million from his father.
It's not been easy for me. It has not been easy for me. And, you know, I started off in Brooklyn. My father gave me a small loan of $1 million. I came into Manhattan and I had to pay him back, and I had to pay him back with interest.
I built what I built myself. And I did it by working long hours and working hard and working smart. More importantly than anything else is by using my own brain. And there was a point where I was making so much, so fast, and it was so easy that I almost got bored. And it's true.
In a chapter on rich fictions, Alyssa, you write about how Trump has pushed the myth that he's a self-made man and spoke to voters who said this was key to their support for him.
Yeah, there was a study done in, I think, Wisconsin in 2018 that talked to Republican and Republican-leaning voters as they were, you know, deciding, voting polling stations, like who they were going to vote for. And they thought he was self-made, and that was part of why they said they were voting for him. And when the researchers kind of laid out the ways that he was not self-made, their ardor to vote for him went down by 10%. I thought it was a fascinating study, and it was something that potentially progressives and Democrats should be thinking about when they're trying to, you know, when they're up against somebody who, in Trump's case, falsely portrays himself as self-made, obviously beneficiary of Fred Trump and millions of dollars and loans and all the rest and, you know, not paying his taxes, that once we show people this, that it can actually be a tool for social change. And we need to sort of puncture the myth whenever it crops up.
And this fixation with the individual effort as determining your success or not, how did that fare during the pandemic and the enormous sense that people had that they needed help in dealing with the pandemic?
I feel like the pandemic taught us a lot of lessons around the value of what I call the art of dependence, the grace and skill and power of depending on other people in our lives, which we all do on some level. But during the pandemic, we were dependent on people to, you know, so-called curbside delivery, which were people. People were curbside delivery, right? We were dependent on our medical system on a grand scale. We were dependent on the parents of our children's friends to do remote schooling if we were doing remote schooling with them in so-called pods, which people wound up hating. But the point being that it was a moment where we recognized how interlocked we were, how complementary. I think we were valuing essential work. We called low-wage workers essential workers, frontline workers, not unskilled, which is a term I really dislike for talking about people who do a good day's job. If anyone's ever made a pizza, you know a guy making a pizza is not unskilled. That we respected those folks. We gave them sometimes hazard pay. I think the pandemic had lessons for us about valuing each other and valuing a certain kind of worker, or maybe sometimes a little, in a way that wasn't sustainable for people, unfortunately. But we need to get back there and to remember the sort of value of those moments of togetherness and interlockingness.
Alyssa Corbett, I want to thank you for being with us, Executive Director of the Economic Hardship Reporting Project. Her new book, Bootstrapped, Liberating Ourselves from the American Dream. That does it for our show. Democracy Now! Is currently accepting applications for a digital fellow. Learn more and apply at democracynow.org. Democracy Now! Is produced with Mike Berker, Nick Feldstein, Gesder, Messiah Rhodes, Nermeen Sheikh, Maria Tarasena, Tammy Warren, Arturina Nadura, Sam Alcoff, Tamari Astudio, John Hamilton, Ravi Karan, Honey Masood, Sanji Lopez. I'm Amy Gooden with Juan Gonzalez.
Wandering Rhythms, Mondays from noon to 2.
Join us in a weekly sample of music from planet Earth.
The strangest mixtape you will ever hear.
Desert blues.
Balkan punk.
Latin funk.
African psych.
Pigeon rap.
And anything and everything else you can imagine, equally represented by all continents.
Because good music is universal.
Wandering Rhythms.
Mondays at noon on CJSF 90.1 FM.